a natural mutation, even a pleasant variation. The sensuous quality of the fur particularly impressed the Sanshium, who crossbred these specimens. Other Feru were soon found grazing on these companions, consuming their fur, and on occasion even consuming the animals themselves. Feru were naturally herbivores. This seemed to activate some sort of biological timer, a signal for expansion. Within a very short time, the Feru were producing far less attractive growths. Flexible, striped rods sprouted from their heads, which in turn were also consumed by fellow Feru, causing abortions and unnatural births. There was no cure, but this was only the surface of the growing infestation. The Feru were soon past recovery. Humans and Sanshium dispatched their pets with regret and puzzlement, for these first stages were beyond their biological understanding. Most researchers believed the Feru had simply become overbred, over-specialized. A few were even returned to their native habitat on Fon Hakor. Then, humans began to manifest the growths. Some humans, it seemed, fancied Feru as food. These humans became vectors. Whatever they touched was also infected, and in time, what they discarded, limbs, tissue, could also spread infection. Thus began the flood. The plague soon spread from human to Sanshium, human to human, but rarely from Sanshium to human, altering their behaviors without yet changing their outward appearance. The infected humans combined their resources to force other humans to become infected. Usually by cannibalism of a sacrificial individual, induced to grow to prodigious size before being consumed while still alive. By this time, dozens of worlds were fully infested and beyond saving. Humans and other animal species began to reshape themselves into other varied and vicious forms equipped to maim and kill and consume, absorb, transform. The infected worlds and even entire systems were quarantined. Many of the infected escaped, however, and spread the plague to hundreds of worlds in 15 systems. Humans were the first to recognize the extreme danger. And this was where the ancient captive in the precursor prison came into the story. Humans had discovered how to communicate with the captive, but only for seconds or minutes at a time. The earliest researchers tried to use it as a kind of oracle, asking the answers to vast and difficult questions of physics and even morality, all of which drew out confused or useless responses. But finally, a set of questions were prepared and asked. They asked about the flood. And what these humans received as answers traumatized them so thoroughly that many committed suicide rather than continue to live with their knowledge. In time, as a kind of defense, access to the captive was reduced, then cut off completely. The human time lock was added. Communication ceased. Most humans came to believe that the captive was an ancient aberration and had been imprisoned by the precursors for just cause, and that its prognostications, if they were such, were nonsensical, even mad. Humans, at the height of the flood's ravages, were pushed to an unexcelled brilliance. They found a cure. Here I detected in the documents the admiration of the Life Shaper herself. Sacrifice yet again. Fully a third of the human species must be themselves altered, placed in the pathway of flood infestation, and fight fire with fire by infecting the flood itself with a destructive set of programmed genes. The flood had no defense. Most of it died off. A few ships carrying the last of the flood escaped and left the galaxy once again, destinations unknown. By the time of this heroic struggle, humans were fighting forerunners as well. Humans were desperate. Their desperation made them cruel. They needed new worlds, uninfected worlds, and took them. Cruelty and apparently irrational conquest and destruction forced forerunners to react decisively. This double war was the source of the Didact's shame. though how he would have altered his conduct had he known was far from clear. Human forces were eradicated, and human-occupied worlds were reduced one by one until the Battle of Chaddam Hakor destroyed the last human resistance. The Sun Shum had already surrendered. None were found to be infected by this so-called plague. All the powdered and infested specimens of the Feru were long dead, destroyed. The original vessels that had carried the glass containers were also destroyed, perhaps in the perverse human wish that forerunners would face a similar infestation and be unprepared. Many forerunners, in fact, regarded the entire story of the Flood, for that was the name humans gave to this spreading infestation, this intergalactic disease, as a fabrication designed to absolve humans and Sun Shum of blame. The rest of the story I knew, or had deduced, and my knowledge matched the Didact's. The librarian was allowed to preserve some human specimens, and to preserve the memory traces of many others, a procedure regarded with much dissent and disgust by orthodox observers of the mantle. But the possibility of the return of the Flood initiated the events which shaped Forerunner history up to my own time, and most of it, nearly all of it, was kept secret by the Master Builder and his guild, my father included. Only a few sympathetic counselors were fully informed. Thus began the conflict with the Prometheans. The Didact proposed vigilance and research, and upon any return of the Flood, however it might manifest, a systematic isolation of infected worlds and, if necessary, immolation. He proposed establishing fortress worlds, shield worlds, across the Forerunner-dominated portions of our galaxy to monitor potential outbreaks and be prepared to fight them with pinpoint precision and minimum destruction. Others had more ambitious solutions. The Didact and the Prometheans faced off against the most extreme faction of builders, now in complete control of the Council. This faction saw both an opportunity to create ultimate weapons against such a threat and a way to maximize and make permanent their political power at the same time. Thus, my father and the Master Builder began to design a series of installations, far fewer in number than the proposed shield worlds, that would become the Halos. By radiating a powerful burst of cross-phased supermassive neutrinos, these installations were capable of destroying all life in an entire star system. Properly tuned and powered, they could do more than that. They could kill all neurologically complex life across whole swaths of the galaxy. The extreme faction won. Fear commanded the Council, and the Council listened. The Didact lost his political battle and was forced into exile. Over the next 1,000 years, 12 such installations were built. Their point of construction was far outside the galaxy, on a superior installation known as the Ark. It acquired that name because of the growing backlash of influence rising from life workers, and in particular from the life shaper herself, the librarian. She insisted that not to make provisions against the ultimate use of the Halos was blasphemy against the mantle. Life workers had their own kind of influence. If they stood down, all medical efforts could cease. The Master Builder saw that giving in to her demands was less expensive than fighting her. And so, the librarian was allowed to gather specimens and recreate their ecological conditions on the Ark itself, even as the Ark finished and transported the first Halos. Utilizing a powerful variety of locked point slipspace transit called portals. The installations had been dispersed. The Halo tested at Chaddam Hakor had been fired at very low power, acting as a test bed. That had been an authorized use. But then a second Halo had been used to punish the Sun Shum. With horror, I realized that what I had witnessed had been only the beginning, and that the Sun Shum worlds, after our brief traumatic visit, had been reduced to the awful condition of biological blandness we had seen on Fawn Hakor. The council had not authorized this use. The master builder had exceeded his authority. He had been accused, even by his colleagues, of blasphemy against the mantle and a crime against nature. What the didact could not understand at the time of my mentoring was why the librarian had chosen this moment to gather specimens from the Sanshum, taking the risk of provoking their rebellion and the master builder's wrath. I found that answer in the council records with the help of my expanded and liberated Ancilla. 300 years before, the flood had returned. It had been discovered in new and unexpected forms on worlds resettled by forerunners after the war. I was caught in a twisted knot of contradictions. Faced with the reality of the flood, I couldn't help but think that the madness of those who had manufactured the halos and set them loose might be the right course. A solid goal, a solid plan, extreme measures against an extreme enemy, fighting for survival against a shapeless threat. The mantle be damned, survival and our way of life was at stake. It all seemed eminently rational. I almost began to believe that it was the didact who was mad, and possibly these young counselors, and not the master builder or my father. Finally, in fury and frustration, I divested myself of my armor, deliberately cutting off contact with the Ancilla, whom I thought had failed me or misled me again. And I slept. If I was in search of peace and certainty, that was my mistake. The didact's actual memories, parts of them, finally blossomed within me.
The arena was equipped with walkways.
I saw vividly, from his point of view, the didact exploring the walkway around the intact, sealed cylinder below.
10,000 years ago.
The didact walked alone around the dome-shaped cap, contemplating whether or not he should activate a human device, something small, designed for a human hand, and fitting like a toy into his own palm. A way of communicating directly with the creature within the cell.
Something manufactured by humans, pushing through precursor technology. How is that possible?
Many questions flashed through the didact's mind, and with difficulty I separated them from my own. Was this actually a precursor, as the humans had at first believed? Or was it something manufactured by precursors? Possibly a strange, distorted sibling to both forerunners and, the didact was reluctant to consider this, humans. Precursor, sibling, or ancestor to what? The didact manipulated the device. The cap over the cylinder became transparent to his eyes, and he saw what lay within. The cell contained, in temporal suspension, a genuine monster, a large creature with an overall anatomy like a grossly misshapen human, though possessed of 4 upper limbs, 2 degenerate legs, and an almost indescribably ugly head. A head shaped remarkably like that of an ancient arthropod seeded long ago on a number of planets, presumably by the precursors, and known to some as Eurypterid, a sea scorpion. Oval, faceted, slanted eyes bumped up from the front of its low, flat face, and from the rear of the head, a long, segmented tail descended the spine, ending in a wicked barb, 2 meters in length. A chime pulled me up short. Disoriented, shivering, unsure who or even what I was, I looked around my cabin, saw my armor slumped in one corner, and a ship's Ancilla blinking rapidly in another. We had finally reached the capital. Even with the extended journey, there had not been enough time to fully integrate. Without the domain, integration might forever elude me, and inside I would always be a fragmented jumble. I tried to recall all that I had seen. Most of it was fading already. I had only a vague impression of the captive, Vague, but frightful. Clearly, those questions that the didact had not resolved to his own satisfaction were more difficult to flush out. But the process had somehow pushed forward a question neither I nor my other memory could answer. Why would they need me if the didact himself had been released and reinstated? Why not go directly to him? Chapter 35. The young counselor seemed to float in place on the command platform, now suspended inside a great sphere, one half of which was also transparent. As I came up through the lift, I saw he was in the company of three others, in appearance much like himself. No doubt more young counselors. Two were male, one was female. Splendid Dust greeted me with one of his disconcerting smiles and introduced me to the others. The names of the two males I did not retain. My memory was so disordered and disjointed. But the female's name stuck with me. She was clearly a warrior's servant by rate, taller than the others by a few centimeters, gracefully but powerfully built, and against all my old and inbred prejudices, she made my heart leap. Her name was Glory of a Far Dawn. They gathered to inspect me. Surrounded by this new breed of first-form forerunners, I felt wretchedly out of place. And in front of this warrior female, with her cool, sharp-eyed gaze lightly sweeping me, then turning aside, I felt like a distorted, storm-twisted stump in the middle of strong, green trees. However, they treated me respectfully enough, and watched with pride the council ship's approach to the capital of our civilization. We were a million kilometers away. The grandeur should have been overwhelming. I tried to share their pride, but more of the didact surfaced. He had been here before, 1,000 years ago, to stand in opposition to the wishes of the master builder. Not pleasant memories.
Greatness and power are often allied with defeat. It is how civilizations are shaped. Some ideas prosper, others die. The quality of the ideas has little to do with the outcome. It is personalities that matter. Pay attention to those around you.
A little cynical, aren't we? I spoke aloud. The counselors turned to me, all but Glory, whose eyes barely flickered. Splendid Dust drew their attention back to the capital itself, and I forced myself to go with this particular flow for now. It is with difficulty that I describe the capital as it was then, so little like anything in your experience. Imagine a planet 100,000 kilometers in diameter, sliced latitudinally, like one of Reiser's favorite fruits. Allow those slices to drop in parallel against a plate. The slices are then pierced through their aligned lower rims with a stick. The plate is removed, and the slices are fanned out in a half circle. Now decorate each slice like a round stair step with an almost infinitely dense array of structures, and surround it with a golden swarm of transports and sentinels, and 12 other varieties of security patrols, thick as fog. No other world like it in the Forerunner universe. Here lay the center of Forerunner power, and the repository of the last 20,000 years of our history, housing the wisdom and accumulated knowledge of trillions of ancillas serving a mere 100,000 forerunners, mostly builders of the highest forms and ranks. There were so many ancillas for so few physical leaders, most never actually interfaced with a forerunner, and so never assumed a visible form. Instead, they performed their operations entirely within the ancilla metarchy, an unimaginably vast network coordinated by a metarch-level intelligence that answered ultimately to the chief counselor. As we approached this magnificence, a thin, silvery arc rose into view above and millions of kilometers beyond the southern axis. My blood cooled. My heart seemed to thud to a stop. Slowly looming in an orbit slightly down star from the capital staggered in perspective like the entrance to a tunnel. 11 great rings had been arranged in neat, precise parking orbits. Halos. The combined might of the Master Builder's weapons, all but one, had been moved to within a few million kilometers of the center of Forerunner power, separated by a minimum of distance and looped together by the slenderest curves of hard light. My other self expressed something beyond alarm, more akin to horror, and I had difficulty stifling an outburst.
They should not be here. Halos should not be allowed anywhere near the seat of governance. Even the Master Builder forbade such a thing. Something has gone very wrong.
The three males among the young counselors did not seem to find the rings even mildly disturbing. One said,
"When we intercept and retrieve the final one, perhaps then our portals will return to their full efficiencies. Moving useless monuments like these puts a strain on all space-time."
Another added, "They've set our reconciliation budget back several thousand years."
In the shadow of doom itself, they think only of commerce and travel.
Now the female warrior, Glory, faced me fully. Eyes still narrow, wary, as if unsure who or what I was, but seeking some sign that I recognized her disapproval of this scene. I met her look, but could say or do nothing. Too many internal contradictions. She looked away, disappointed, and stepped to the other side of the group on the command platform. "How long must we suffer for the Master Builder's arrogance?" Splendid Dust said. He then addressed me, utilizing, perhaps without realizing it, the forms of speech used towards those of a lower rate. "The weapons of the old regime have a regal beauty, do they not? Soon all will be gathered here, and a decision will be made as to their deactivation and disposition. Truly, this will be a new age for the Forerunners, an age free of suicidal madness and fear. A time of peace and security will soon be at hand." Within 5,000 kilometers of the capital, our ship was silently surrounded by the flowing rainbow pulses of the capital's controlling and meshing sensory fields, then chivied gently by hardlight docking nets. Hundreds of small service craft quickly flew up to surround us like a swarm of gnats around a campfire. Splendid Dust formally congratulated the ship's Ancilla, and in turn received a ceremonial token of record for the journey. A small golden disc bearing the cost of reconciliation from the Slipspace Fund. He requested immediate transport for all on the viewing platform to a reception hall 500 kilometers below, on the outer edge of the greatest of the fan slices. I listened to the formalities with rapidly dulling interest. Something unpleasant was in the offing. That much I was sure. The didact within me was sure. I didn't care to distinguish between the two of me anymore. Together, we knew the Master Builder better than any of these young counselors. A forerunner of nearly infinite complexity and mental resources, cunning with as many centuries as the didact himself, wiser still in the ways of forerunner politics and technology. Splendid Dust watched two of his colleagues depart for their waiting transit craft, the males chatting happily about the journey they had just completed. He and Glory of a Far Dawn stayed with me. "We're moving you to a secure domicile," the young counselor told me. "You'll be afforded all the protection we merit as counselors, and perhaps more."
"Why?"
I asked.
"I can't complete my integration. I'm useless to myself, much less to anyone else."
I couldn't bring myself to offer him my even blunter assessment of his situation. Caution, above all. I could not know who was actually friend or foe, dupe or master. And I felt distinct shame before the warrior female. "I admire your fortitude," he told me, "and your presence of mind, but in fact I am politely observing the request of the librarian, who may soon be able to return from her duties. When she does, we will, I hope, learn why you were so important and how you may finally be of use."
"She shouldn't come anywhere near this place," I growled.
"I agree," he said. Not all those who had supported the Master Builder are content with the current state of affairs. But the Life Shaper rarely listens to reason. Builder reason, that is. He gestured to Glory. Accompany Bornstellar to his quarters and acquaint him with his security detail. She nodded and complied. Chapter 36. My domicile on the outskirts of the equatorial disk city bore the council's austere yet supremely comfortable hallmark. My escort instructed me in the functions of the small chamber, saw to my immediate needs, and assured me that I would be free to come and go once all precautions had been taken.
I am used to these appointments, I told her. Remember, I'm a builder.
Glory listened with a strange sort of deference that seemed to mock me, but without disrespect. My other memory regarded this with an odd, youthful thrill. I could not imagine the Didact having ever been young, or feeling such a thrill in the presence of a female of his kind.
Our kind.
You must never remove your armor in chambers, Glory said. Witnesses for the council are afforded the highest levels of protection, which require armor at all times. Such measures may be adjusted after the trial.
And the trial is scheduled for when? I asked.
Within 10 domestic days. The accused has been in council custody for a pentad, the fifth part of a domestic year. Since shortly after the incident at the San Shum system, the Didact's wisdom within me made no comment. Glory and her security team withdrew. I felt snubbed for no good reason. She had left without a backward look or any other sign.
What would you expect? She's honorable.
I studied my confines. The walls could melt away at whim and show any number of environments. Beautiful, artificial environments mostly, created by ancient masters. I cared nothing for that. I was alone with my armor and Ancilla. And no doubt variety of morally acceptable entertainments, highly mannered and formalistic, though, once again, as always now, I was not alone in my thoughts. I put my armor through an unnecessary diagnostic, found no problems, then made a brief attempt to determine the state of the domain. As I had been informed, it was still not accessible. My Ancilla expressed regret and dismay at this state of affairs. The domain is essential to an event such as a major political trial, she said, her color shading to a disappointed purple. The judges assess precedent through the domain, and through the domain the witnesses and their testimony may be subject to verification.
I'm just glad it isn't my fault, I said.
No, but that would be a more reassuring explanation. Perhaps I can find clues in the council's physical knowledge banks. At least we have been guaranteed access to those. As for your own integration, I believe you should be allowed to sleep. Your dreams may be useful.
Is the domain like dreaming?
Not truly, but some have theorized that the dreams of ancient forerunners accessed the ground that supports the domain.
I shuddered. Forerunners seem to get along quite well never leaving their armor, never sleeping, never dreaming.
Some would say this practice is not optimal, that individuals lose flexibility.
She was either testing my patience or trying to draw out a response. None of the females around me, even this simulacrum, were providing any sort of ease or solace. I remembered Riser's comment about the blue female. And some say that we place entirely too much trust in Ancillas to manage our mental states, our personal internal affairs, true?
Yes, she agreed primly. Some say that. I hope you disagree.
Slipspace is overloaded with transit, I said. The domain is inaccessible. Our highest officials are either locked in power struggles, exiled in hiding, or confined for trial. I'm not who I once was. My family suffers from my actions, and everything I ever wanted to know or do has turned out to be horribly complicated.
For that, I must assume a portion of blame.
I would say so, yes. And the librarian must share it with you. I see her mark all over these events, don't you?
Have I ever denied her influence?
The didact's wisdom roused at this. I could feel his interest, but for the moment did not contribute. But to what end, I asked. Why promote the creation of a distortion such as me? And why give the humans a deeply buried Gaius? What good did that do them? They are no doubt dead, and all their ancient memories with them. You're as much a victim as I am, and a victim is not likely to be of much use to another victim.
I am an artificial construct. I cannot be a victim. I do not have a presence in the aura of the mantle.
Such humility. The figure in the back of my thoughts pulsed with something like indignation, then withdrew from my internal viewpoint.
I will conduct my poor researches as best as I am able, she said. Humility will be my watchword.
I could, of course, summon her back any time I wished, but I felt no need for now. Against instructions, I removed my armor and sat cross-legged on the floor, as I had observed the didact do on Erde Tyrene and on his ship, it seemed, ages ago. I wanted to closely observe everything I naturally possessed, all my internal states.
You do this instinctively, First Form?
I tried to ignore this. I would take charge of my own thoughts, restructuring them if I was able. Reshape myself, create my own internal discipline without the didact, without the ancilla, without the support of family and form, and of course, without access in the domain. An impossible task.
Not so impossible. It is what every warrior does the dawn before battle. Strength in conflict does not arise from the niceties and never has. Do you feel it? That battle is about to begin?
Please, be quiet.
Agreed. This is your time, First Form.
Without your guidance?
Of course.
I'm so glad I have your permission.
Think nothing of it. In fact, think nothing.
That proved amazingly difficult. Somehow, hours later, I emerged from a blankness like a fish flying out of a deep pond. I could almost see myself twisting in the air, spraying glittering drops. And then I was simply a First Form, of no particular distinction, sitting alone in a minimally comfortable chamber. But I had done it. I had thought of nothing, and maintained that state for a considerable length of time. I allowed myself a small rictus, all I could manage, and then got up to put on my armor. I felt far less defiant now than I had just hours before. Not compliant, just at peace, and ready for whatever might come. My ancilla returned and flashed in warning. I was being summoned. The door to my chamber opened, and one of the embodied, armed, cyclopean ancillas known as monitors appeared, flanked by two guards from Builder Security. Both were male. Neither were warrior servants.
The council requests your presence, one told me.
I'm ready, I said.
We offer the service of checking your appearance,
the other guard said. Not necessary, I replied.
Indeed, you seem to have experience in such matters. Your armor fits in the fashion proper for council inquiry. Your bearing is strong yet respectful.
Thank you. Let's get this over with. They accompanied me through lift and corridor to the council transit center on the edge of the equatorial disk, and there into the nearest councillor shuttle. Four more monitors joined us. Unnecessary force, I thought. Here, in the heart of the council's power, it seemed unlikely I would need so much protection. The didact's wisdom disagreed. And I also noted, adjacent to our shuttle, that dozens of small Falco-class space pods were being lined up outside the equatorial disk's gravity gradient, in close vicinity to a lift station devoted to council use. I wondered about that. Falcos were generally used in the evacuation of interplanetary transports. The journey to the central quartz tier took just a few moments.
Through the shuttle's transparent cowling, we watched as hundreds of other shuttles arrived with tightly choreographed grace and dignity, carrying the required quorum of 500 counselors from around the Ecumene. I wondered how many of them were first forms from the new assignments.
Not our concern.
I wondered why not.
There will be no trial. Soon, there may be no council and no capital.
That was all the Didact's wisdom thought fit to convey. Alarming enough. Again, I flashed on the 11 halos in their parking orbits. Impossibly slender, perfectly circular silvery rings flashing in the sun. The tangled weave of events was far from certain. There was nothing I could do for the moment but go along. Splendid Dust and five of his aides, all first forms, all smiling and proud, joined our phalanx of armed ancillas and builder security. A great moment is coming, the young counselor told me as we followed a broad hallway equipped with high, rotating sculptures of quantum-engineered crystal. Soon, the walls themselves were decorated with regular patterns of the same sort of crystal. Splendid Dust proudly explained that these were spent slipspace flakes, many millions of them. Truly, the Ecumene was ancient and powerful. Truly, that would never change, I hoped. We then came upon the Great Council Amphitheater, a floating bowl connected to the rest of the capital's main structure by richly decorated bridges and docked ornamental ferries. Those are little used now, the young counselor explained, along with arching lift tubes designed to drop the most senior counselors straight into the amphitheater without the indignity of mingling with their peers. Ornate and decorated, indeed. Splendid Dust joined a group of his fellow counselors and spoke with them while our escorts located our boxes and seats where we might most comfortably and prominently await our summons.
Pomp trumps security.
I looked up at the rows and wondered at how small the amphitheater actually was to represent the governance of the Ecumene. 3 million fertile worlds. Yet only 500 seats and perhaps 100 boxes. 4 speaking platforms at the 4 compass points of the amphitheater. All remarkably simple compared with the capital world itself. The covering dome sliced into quarters and peeled away. Great display spheres dropped into place, sparkling with representations of the 12 great systems of the early forerunners, each carrying a unique sacred epistle of the mantle's creed and prayer. The young counselor moved closer and confided, "We'll separate now. You'll be vetted and prepared for your invocation. 3 other witnesses will be inducted into the gravity of the counselor court."
"The Didact?"
"His duties have taken him elsewhere. You will testify in his place."
"Is that appropriate? I have not his presence and experience."
"You saw what he saw with respect to these proceedings, and you have his imprimatur."
I wasn't sure how I felt about that. Would anything at all be left of Bornstellar when this was finished? Then I thought of the humans. Perhaps soon I would learn whether they were still alive, but only if their fates mattered to these powerful forerunners. Unlikely.
The amphitheater quickly and quietly filled. No one spoke as the court arranged itself. From the center of the amphitheater rose the platform that would hold the 6 judges, surrounded by a circle of cyclopean monitors and the lower rank of dark-armored council security. Among them, I was quick to note, were 4 warrior servants, including Glory of a Far Dawn. The platform ascended to a height of 50 meters, revealing heavily armed, gleaming black sentinels circling its great lower pistons. I asked my ancilla whether such protection was traditional.
"No," she said. "Listen closely to the Didact's wisdom."
"Is the librarian here?"
"She was not invited."
"Is she with the Didact?"
"They have not seen each other for 1,000 years."
That was no answer. But I knew better than to ask what could not be known. Too many secrets, too much power, too much privilege. Suddenly I felt that cold repugnance so familiar from my days as a manipular, when I feared becoming such as these, when I feared being
responsible. The assistants and aides cleared the main amphitheater to find their places on the outer tiers. Soon enough, I sat alone in my box. Alone, but flanked by two monitors, their sensor eyes bright red. I wondered if all these monitors were essential to the proceedings. They are not, my Ancilla said resentfully. I am fully capable. She then dimmed and shrank to the back of my thoughts, as if these armed artificial intelligences overwhelmed her with their presence and power. I tried to still all curiosity, all expectations, all concerns.
Think nothing.
I failed. The amphitheater remained quiet as a second platform shoved through a gate on the far side of the bowl. Here was the accused, presumably. The master builder himself, shrouded for the moment behind iridescent green curtains, preserving decorum, if not all dignity. I actually looked forward to witnessing the master builder's discomfort when those curtains faded and pulled away. Abject. Humbled. The ceremonies of induction and oath were brief. A Metark-level monitor rose from the floor of the amphitheater, its single sensor sapphire blue. When it had ascended to a level with the platform supporting the master builder, still concealed behind the curtain, it fixed in place, and a brief series of chiming notes spread outward in sweet, silvery waves. The first observer of the court, the very counselor who had accompanied me from my family's world, raised his arm. The council recognizes the authority of the builder and warrior servant corps of the Capitol Court in the matter of multiple indictments against the builder known as Faber, once entitled Master Builder. All appointed makers of law sit now in orderly and considerate judgment. Witnesses have been gathered. Be it noted that the accused has yet to formally acknowledge the council and these proceedings. A murmur of disapproval. Again, silence fell over the amphitheater. Then, from behind the green curtain, a much smaller monitor floated into its appointed place. It appeared older than any of the structures around us, older perhaps than the Capitol world itself, which would have made it more than 25,000 years old. Its eye glowed a dull, vegetal green. I had heard of this embodied Ancilla, of course. All forerunners had. Simply the thought that I was within range of that fabled sensor eye sent a ripple of cool expectation and reverence through my body. This was the warden, both prison keeper and guardian of mercy, for every accused forerunner expects that those who confine must also be those who will in time defend and perhaps release. Such is the ancient law, which has as its foundation the mantle itself. The green curtain now drew aside. I was disappointed by the simple dignity of it all. No humbled, bowed figure, no chains, no chance of disapproval. But of course that last would have been unthinkable. Faber stood within a confinement field, still as a statue, only his eyes moving as he surveyed the amphitheater, the members of the council, and his judges. The sleek gray and blue head with its fringe of white hair seemed little changed. Adversity, such adversity as he had faced, had left him unbowed. The council, in turn, silently examined the subject of their proceedings. Faber's eyes continued their slow sweep, as if seeking someone in particular. The steady gaze finally fixed on me. His recognition was obvious, though he did not move a muscle. He observed me for a moment from across the amphitheater, then turned aside to await the oath-taking of the panel of six judges. Of the judges, two were builders, one a miner, one a life worker, a male, the first life worker I had seen since I was a child, and two were warrior servants. These were arrayed in the armor of security. Thus were all the rates represented, except for the engineers, of course. The warden dissolved the field around the master builder. Faber, I corrected myself.
No need. He has lost none of his power.
The council remained standing. The first observer now lowered his arm and began to speak. It has been the policy of some high builders, including the previous council, to carry out their plans without fully informing all forerunners. It is the policy of the new council that no forerunner shall remain ignorant of the peril we face, and have faced for 300 years, of an assault from outside the boundaries of our galaxy, intruding through the outer reaches of the spiral arm which contains our glorious Orion cluster, of the remedies that have been designed and deployed and now are recalled, of the current strategic situation, and how that must change as we adapt to new threats. For the heart of any indictment against Faber must be that he sought power through deception and manipulated the emotions of key forerunners to push through a scheme in direct contravention to the mantle itself.
The Master Builder, for so my other memory insisted on still thinking of him, returned his gaze to meet mine and gave the merest nod, as if in invitation.
Soon. Young Forerunner. He cannot carry out his plans without you.
The proceedings continued with a bone-dulling litany of ritual observances and purifications. The various monitors were rotated around the court and formally sworn in by the first observer. Absolutely unnecessary, I knew, since no Ancilla had ever betrayed instructions or loyalty to Forerunners. Hours seemed to pass. At what I hoped was the end of this endless procedure, a small murmur again rose from the council seats. The armed monitors that had returned to their places beside me rotated as if seeking something. Their sensors seemed to darken. Their motions slowed. Then, as one, they all brightened and returned to normal. For a moment, nothing seemed amiss. All was as before. But finally, I saw the anomaly attracting attention and comment from the counselors and judges. A small, green point of light maneuvered until it hovered like some improbable firefly just beneath the display spheres. At first, I thought it must be part of the ritual, but no one else seemed to share that opinion. Now the green point brightened, crossed the center of the amphitheater, and hovered before the Master Builder, who looked puzzled. Almost immediately, his eyes grew large in alarm, and he raised his hands as if in defense, before he brought his body and expression back under control. Yet his eyes continued to follow the moving point. I wondered what could possibly cause the Master Builder such concern.
Our bastard child, his and mine.
The point intensified and expanded. I tried to access my Ancilla to determine what it might be. She appeared, but locked in an awkward position, arms raised, frozen in an attitude of warning. Then she winked out completely, and my armor seized up. It would not release me, no matter how hard I struggled. For the moment, there was nothing to do but stand like a statue. The amphitheater was filled with counselors, judges, prosecutors, also frozen. One by one, the monitors and all the sentinels and other security units began to waver, their sensors winking out. As one, they fell, striking the walls and boxes, ricocheting, landing and rolling on the floor, inert, helpless, dead. In the center of the chamber, the brilliant green dot glowed steadily. I could not turn away. With a convulsive shiver, my armor began to move against my will, turning me around. The door to the corridor behind the box opened. My armor took me through. Everything beyond was dark. It seemed as if all council chambers were without power. For the next few minutes, I felt my limbs being marched through the black corridors. I sensed forward and sideways motion, but saw nothing. On occasion, I could determine the size of a space I was in by the echo of my feet. Then I was slammed to an abrupt halt. The green light flashed before me, spun about, seemed to come closer. My Ancilla reappeared in the back of my thoughts, but this time she was ghastly green, her face smooth, no features whatsoever, and her arms and legs had been reduced to quick strokes as if by a young, clumsy artist. "What is this?" I asked. "Where are we going?" The green figure rotated, then pointed to my left. I shifted my eyes. A crack of light appeared. A hatch leading, I saw, to the hall of slipspace crystals.
Through that crack shot a brighter, more focused glow. It was useless protesting. The Didact's wisdom said nothing. It did not need to. I was being guided involuntarily toward a destination that had nothing to do with being a witness for the council. That was likely all done with. More monitors came into view. They clustered on the opposite side of the hall, rotating around each other like balls in a magician's invisible hand. Then a new, resonant voice spoke within my armor, lacking all implied gender or even character. I have exhausted the domain, and yet I am not complete. I require service. Are you of service?
I don't even know what you are, I said.
I require service. I sensed an almost physical pressure, and had to resist having my thoughts, my mind, sucked into this sketchy green form. I had seen this kind of hunger before, but never so overwhelming and all-demanding. The hunger of an ancilla for knowledge, a tremendously powerful ancilla with no apparent master.
Are you here in the capital? I asked.
I protect all, I require service.
Why come to me?
The metarchy can serve you. Surely I am contender. I am above the metarchy. My designers built in latent control of all systems in the capital. Should an emergency arise, it has arisen. The Didact's wisdom, silent until now, suddenly took control of my speech, my thoughts, and shunted me aside.
Mendicant bias.
I heard myself say.
Beggar after knowledge. That is the name I gave you when last we met. Do you recognize that name?
I recognize that name, the sketchy green ancilla replied. Then the figure moved from the back of my thoughts and seemed to pass directly through my forehead, taking shape as a projected form directly in front of me.
Do you recognize the one who named you?
The green image briefly flickered. You are not that one. No other knows that name.
Shall I guide you to further service?
At this point, I had no idea who was speaking or to what purpose. I require further input. The domain is insufficient.
Liberate this armor and prepare a path. Do you know where the Master Builder resides?
The Master Builder gave me my final set of orders.
But I am the one who knows your chosen name, your true name, and who commanded your construction.
That is so.
Then I am your client and master. Release me.
I have a new master. You are dangerous to my new master.
I know your true name. I can revoke your key and shut you down.
That is no longer possible. I am beyond the metarchy. The Didact within me suddenly spoke a series of words and numbers. The green ancilla wavered like a flame in a high wind. Symbols appeared in the space behind my thoughts, swirling like a cloud of birds, combining, matching, then dropping into orderly columns as, one by one, the spoken and numerical symbols of the ancilla's secret key were expressed. At this point, I was just a passenger in my own body, controlled from without by hijacked armor and from within by the Didact's wisdom. The struggle suddenly ended. The green ancilla vanished. My armor unlocked.
Run.
I ran as fast as the armor allowed, very fast indeed, through a sluggish maze of recovering monitors and sentinels, across the plaza surrounding the amphitheater hemisphere, up onto a broad ledge looking out over the rim of equatorial disk, where I was intercepted by a guard who spun me into a constraint field. For an awful moment, I thought I was back in the hands of the Master Builder's troops. Until I saw the face of Glory of Afar Dawn, and noticed that on her other side, she was also dragging the first counselor, the first observer of the court, Splendid Dust himself, in another field. Our trip across the plaza ended when, with a sudden leap, the female warrior servant propelled us through the weakened buffer field, which threw a sparking glow around us, and beyond the gravitational gradient, out into empty space, with nothing to stop our fall for at least 100 kilometers.
Chapter 37.
As I fell, my blue ancilla reacquired definition and control. Apologies, she said. I am no longer connected to the Metarchy or any other network. I cannot fully serve you.
Never mind that, I said. Find something to catch me.
That has already been arranged.
I swung about and bumped into the field that held the first counselor. Our fields merged with a distinct pressure pop. Also with us in the field, Glory herself, curling up as if expecting imminent impact. A Falco-class rescue pod slid in from my left, matched our descent, and blipped open a hatchway. Grapples reached out and caught us, then yanked us clumsily inside. The interior of the Falco rearranged to accommodate three passengers and cushion further acceleration. Still, even in my armor, I felt sick as the tiny craft spun about and then launched into full evacuation mode. In a few minutes, we were away from the disk, the whole arrangement of slices, away from the planet itself, following an oblong orbit to observe from 1,000 kilometers out in space. The entire arrangement of the capital's disks seemed to be slowly, painfully realigning to the original sphere.
The capital is under siege,
the didact within me said.
What is mendicant bias? I asked, while closely watching our passage through a slow, stately rain of disabled sentinels, monitors, and uncontrolled craft, the near boundary of the planet's disabled protection.
Better to ask where we are going.
Glory pulled herself up, then tugged upon the first counselor, who seemed stunned. Crammed together as we were, I hoped we were not in this for the long haul. I hoped there would soon be other arrangements. Still, I could not see any other Falcos, or for that matter, any other escapees from whatever chaos had embroiled the capital.
All right, I said. Where are we going?
Are you asking me? Splendid Dust said, his face purple with dismay. I haven't any idea what's just happened. The Metarchy has been disabled,
Glory of a Far Dawn said.
All control has been moved to an external authority. I was instructed by my commanders to rescue at least 2 of the counselors.
Splendid Dust looked between us.
I seem to have rescued you instead, she said to me,
deadpan. We were now in a position to see again the great rings of the orbiting installations. They were no longer arranged linearly, but had spread out into a pentagon and a hexagon, along with another outlying ring, slowly moving to join with the pentagon. It seemed that after 43 years, the prodigal halo had returned.
Bearing what madness? The captive itself? Overkill beyond all reason. This is utterly pointless. What is its goal?
Whose goal? What's goal? The others stared at me. I was babbling to myself.
Mendicant bias, a contender class, the first of its kind. It is as far above most ancillas